Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. Apologize for the tardy start. Had some traffic issues on the way in today. We're going to start with some committee business. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Warner.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just the first item on your agenda is committee business, and just try to mention some of the things we're working on and some of you are involved in as well. The first is we continue to work with a nonprofit property tax work group, and Kyle's been working with them. Senator Boquist, Senator Riley are in that group. I think we're looking at early October for our next meeting that Kyle's putting together, and hopefully moving toward some proposed legislation. We will have a placeholder as a committee bill, basically just so you'll have a vehicle to put in what the work group decides. The second thing I wanted to mention is that you remember from Senate Bill 61 from last session, 15 session, you directed us to do prepare a report on the tax haven legislation, and we will be getting our first round of data from the Corporate Division of Department of Revenue here this fall, and we'll put that together for you could see what's happened in terms of the impact of the tax haven law that was passed in 13. You'll also be getting, and there we'll be working with them too. The Department of Revenue is required to issue a report every 2 years for the regular session on recommendations to change the list on the tax haven. So that'll be coming to you in January as well. And then a couple of other things. In the short session in 14, there was a change in apportionment for broadcasters, and that's you also assigned us to come back to you with an analysis of how that affected things. Chris will be working on that, and that's due also early in the session, so it'll be in 2017. That's a complex one because most of these broadcasters are part of consolidated returns that include other entities that are non-broadcaster related, but we did require that information be provided on the return, so Chris will have something to work with and will report to you. And finally, he's working on his biennial tax credit report too that will come to you in January of next year. So those are kind of the things that we're working on, and we'll have more information for you on those in a few months.
Thank you. All of those reports, while they seem somewhat obscure, occupied a great deal of time right up here one time or another. So mm-hmm. Comments on any of those things in the work group?
Other than we're still working.
Yes. Yeah.
And we're a long ways from the recommendation you just mentioned.
And
so please don't be ringing my office for 6 appointments today, okay?
Well, it's much anticipated, as you know. Whatever those recommendations are.
It is much more complex than we even thought at this diocese originally.
Yes. Thanks for bringing this whole issue to us, by the way. So we want to move now to an issue that passed, I believe, in 2013 in
a session
that was often called the Grand Bargain. And one of the components of that was to help small businesses through a lower tax rate, and we're going to take a panel of CPAs up here. If you guys want to come forward, Dick Solomon, Cliff Mance, Michael Lortz, and Heather Jackson, and talk about how that's worked in reality, and what the goal was, what the theory was, what the intent was, and what we're seeing now, and was hopefully some paths to move forward. Welcome.
Okay. I'll go ahead and start. Good morning, Senator Mark Haas and Vice Chair Senator Boquist and members of the Senate Interim Finance Revenue Committee. I am Heather Jackson on behalf of the Oregon Society of CPAs. I'm the chair of the Taxation Committee this year. What I'd like to kind of highlight is from the OSCPA side of things and how we were dealing with it from the membership side of it. The rest of the people will bring up their personal or the actual practice of it. One of the things that we came across was there wasn't a lot of publicity about it. We used our networks within our society to try to push information out, but that doesn't reach taxpayers or all tax preparers in the state of Oregon. So with that said, we got a lot of communication from people we've never heard of from before trying to get information. We did use the prac.revenue@oregon.gov email a lot and got a lot of information. But again, the answers weren't always consistent based on what we were getting. So we would put out a specific question, and the answers weren't extremely specific, even though the questions were very specific. And trying to get as many answers and clarifications we could and then disseminate it to people. So kind of having a better method or better interpretation of what's going on would be helpful, especially from the CPA side of it. If we're having trouble, I can't imagine what the taxpayers are trying to do without any help.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you today. For the record, my name is Richard B. Solomon. I am a certified public accountant who has practiced in Portland for over 40 years. My work is limited to preparation of tax returns primarily for high net worth individuals and professionals like doctors and lawyers. I am here at the request of Chairman Haas and represent only myself. Briefly, I believe the legislature should repeal the reduced tax rate for income from pass-through entities because the law is expensive and unfair. The objective of HB 3601 that established a reduced rate on income from pass-through entities was to create jobs. Did it accomplish its goal, and is it cost-effective? No. The PTE provision is expensive and inefficient. I think we all agree that if you spend money or reduce your revenue, you should get something for it. But my experience is that business owners didn't add any new workers based on this provision. In fact, none of my clients who benefited from the PTE provision even knew the provision existed. They only learned of it after I completed preparation of their 2015 tax return and told them how much money they'd saved. My clients, who are either partners in large law or medical practices or are S-Corp shareholders, each saved between $6,000 and $19,000. None hired any additional employees. They didn't do anything to get their tax break. They qualified for the provision only because they already had existing staff and because their businesses were structured as pass-through entities. So the state lost revenue while no new jobs were created. In fact, these taxpayers would have gotten the preferential tax rate even if they had reduced the number of employees, as long as the firm had just one employee working 1,200 hours a year. The PTE tax rate provision also fails the fairness test. A taxpayer is eligible for the PTE reduced rate only if they are an S-Corp shareholder or a member in a multi-member LLC. Sole proprietors and owners of a single-member LLC are not eligible. To illustrate the inequity, let's say you have two brothers who have exactly the same income, but one operates as a sole proprietor and the other has an S-corporation. The S-corp shareholder benefits while the sole proprietor does not. So the provision is unfair in that it treats similarly situated taxpayers in very different ways. In summary, the motivation behind HB 3601, which established the preferential rate for income from pass-through entities, while well-meaning, fails in the real world because it acts more like a gift than a motivator for creating jobs. The law should be repealed. If the legislature wants to promote job growth, it should take the dollars saved by repeal of this provision to provide direct incentives to employers to add workers. Make employers hire workers, to get a benefit. Thank you for the opportunity to address you today. I'm happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Solomon. Can you give me your clients who benefited from this were not just wealthy retirees. They had law offices and doctors and things like
right.
that.
Chair Haas, in order to benefit from the PTE, you have to be actively engaged in a trade or business. So these were doctors, these were professional people who were engaged in their practice.
And you said someone saved $19,000?
Yes.
As a surprise? Or
well, number one, he didn't know about it, and he already had two or three staff people. He was a surgeon, and I told him he saved $19,000. He said thank you. He had no idea it existed, and in his case, he couldn't have done anything more to either increase or decrease this, because the only thing he needed to do to qualify was have one employee who would work 1,200 hours. Now this gentleman makes quite a large income, you know.
Well, it must have been a pleasant phone call for him from you that day.
It's a more pleasant phone call than some that I make.
Other questions of these two CPAs?
I'll correct the record at the end, but let me just clarify something, since there's obviously confusion here at the diocese. What we passed in that special session, as the good accountant said, only is active income. So there's no retirees making money out of this. The discussion, because I was on the work group up to it, just to clarify, is that most of us wanted to leave doctors, lawyers out of this, the LLPs, because the intent was trying to come up with mechanisms in which you could get equity capital, in which you could then match with debt, borrowed debt, right, for business expansion, not in law firms, not in the medical practice. I could go down a laundry list of individuals not in my party who were probably as adamant as I was that we should leave lawyers out of this thing. But there is this thing called classes where you can't screw the lawyer and then give the manufacturer a benefit. And so that's sort of how we ended up in that category that was there. So yes. The only other comment I would say is that, as I've told members of the state board, be cautious about making some recommendation, because the state board has come, tax preparers board or whatever has come forward and said, you're leaving us out for liability. There's also the flip side of liability. If you're promoting raising the taxes on your clients, just let me give you a word of caution.
Thank you for the clarification. And I said retirees, and I shouldn't have, but I know Mr. Solomon has retirees on his client list. So. Other questions of these two CPAs? Then let's thank you. If you guys can stand by, bring up Mr. Benz and Mr. Warren.
Good morning. Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to participate in today's hearing. For the record, my name is Michael Lortz. I'm a certified public accountant with the firm of Geffen Mesher in Portland, Oregon, and the views expressed herein are my own. As a CPA, I routinely advise Oregon taxpayers who own businesses with respect to opportunities and threats from a tax perspective. I also prepare Oregon income tax returns for companies and individuals. After House Bill 3601 became law in late 2013, I educated myself on the bill and began meeting with clients to discuss the opportunities related to the reduced tax rates that began in 2015. Now that most of our clients have filed their 2015 income tax returns, I'd like to offer the following comments and observations. Most of our clients who benefited from the lower tax rates did not have to do anything different to receive the benefit. They already had Oregon employees. They were already working actively in their businesses. None of the clients I work with hired employees as a result of this law. The Oregon Department of Revenue implemented the law in a manner that disproportionately benefited taxpayers with significant income from sources other than from their businesses. For example, investment income or a spouse with income earned from a separate employer. And let me give a brief example of that, and I will use the law firm example. So I have a number of law firms as clients, and the partners of those firms are diverse. Some of them are young lawyers, and others have had a significant career. In theory, all of those partners of the law firms could potentially benefit from these reduced tax rates. In practice, what happened is that the older lawyers who were either married to a spouse generating income or had significant investment income, they benefited significantly from this reduced tax rate because of the way that it's been implemented by the Department of Revenue. Whereas the younger partners who tended to not be married or tended to not have investment income, they did not benefit nearly as significantly. And in fact, in many cases, they did not benefit from it at all. Whether or not taxpayers benefited from the lower tax rates also depended on the legal form of their businesses. For example, limited liability companies with a single owner generally did not qualify for the tax reduction, and neither did owners of corporations taxed as C corporations. In some cases, we advised changing the legal structure of these businesses in order to qualify for the lower rates. A brief example, one of our clients has a significant business in East Clackamas County, and that business was organized as a single-member LLC, one owner. We went to this client and explained this opportunity for lower tax rates, but said, based on your existing structure, you won't qualify for it because you have an LLC with one owner. And yes, we know it doesn't make a lot of sense, but if you simply were to add a second owner to that LLC, all of a sudden you would qualify for these reduced tax rates. The simple solution was to add the spouse as an owner. Now we have two owners of the LLC. That LLC now is a partnership as opposed to a sole proprietorship for tax purposes. They had to pay us some extra money to file a partnership tax return. However, that cost was significantly outweighed by the tax savings that it produced. The law does not allow taxpayers to amend their tax returns to claim the benefit of the reduced tax rates if they failed to do so on their originally filed returns. This is unusually harsh, particularly because there are times when a taxpayer must amend their tax returns for no fault of their own. Perhaps they're receiving information from a third party, and perhaps that third party now provides them with corrected or updated information, requiring them to amend their tax returns. If on their original return they failed to elect the reduced tax rates, perhaps it wasn't going to benefit them, but now with this new information, now it would have benefited them. Unfortunately, that taxpayer is precluded by this law of amending their returns to elect the reduced rate. That doesn't make much sense. As a note, the largest amount of tax saved that I have seen so far in my client base was received by a non-resident. A non-resident married couple, they own a business that has significant operations in the state of Oregon, and their 2015 Oregon taxes were reduced by over $80,000 as a result of HB 3601. It's interesting, this particular client actually moved the company headquarters out of the state of Oregon several years ago to a state with a lower tax rate. I don't know what would have happened if this had been available back then, but it was an unexpected benefit. In closing, a couple of recommendations. I recommend that this law be modified so that business owners benefit from the reduced tax rates regardless of their company's legal structure. In addition, taxpayers ought to be able to claim the benefit on amended returns, even if they did not originally do so. And finally, if increased employment is a desired outcome of this law, Other approaches, such as providing tax credits to reduce the impact of state employment taxes, could be more effective in stimulating increased employment. Thank you for the opportunity to share my observations related to this topic.
Thank you. Let's hold off questions until we hear from Mr. Banks.
Yeah, so Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here today. My name is Clint Bentz. I'm a certified public accountant and a partner with the firm Bolt Carlisle Smith here in the Mid-Valley of Salem, Staten, and Albany. I'm a practicing CPA. I've got a large number of tax clients, including clients who are eligible for these reduced rates on qualifying pass-through income. My opinions today are my own, not my firm's. I was involved, I worked closely with the House Revenue Committee as this law was being worked through the process. And since the passage, I've seen many problems in how this was rolled out and implemented by the Oregon Department of Revenue, and some things may need legislative action to correct. In fact, I looked for the rulemaking, and I didn't find any evidence that this ever went through a rule process at ODR. I think they just took the law and tried to figure out what it meant. HB 3601 was not designed as a jobs bill. It was part of the bipartisan effort called the Grand Bargain, right? In the 2013 special session, we raised $244 million of new revenue through adjusting the senior medical deduction. We put a higher tax rate on C corporations. We removed the personal exemption for high income taxpayers. And we put a 13-cent per pack boost in the cigarette tax. So that was $244 million of new revenue that came into the 13-15 biennium. And only partially offsetting this increase in taxes was a large one-year boost to K-12 education, which happened in 14. And then in 15, we started this the pass-through tax. So this was an offset to help taxpayers, and it was part of the bargain. One party, you know, between the parties, this was how it worked out to get the increase in taxes on one. They gave some reduction on the other and some money for the schools. The employee requirement was put in place primarily to make sure that this bill, this relief, went to Oregon employers, right? So we wanted not just people who had their own job, but we wanted to make sure that this relief went to employers. It wasn't designed to have them increase employment, although that was a side benefit I think people hoped for, or maybe those people that didn't have any employees might go hire one so that they could get in. But it wasn't a jobs bill in the beginning. It's further limited to people who materially participate in their business. So this is no retirees, no investors get this credit. These are working people who own their business and are working in the business that get the credit. The other parts of the grand bargain were the PERS thing, which got struck down, and some other some GMO stuff. There are provisions in this legislation where the Legislative Revenue Office had to make an initial assessment of how much benefit this was actually going to generate, and then to, after it happened, after the first biennium, to actually then assess and see if, you know, how it was working, if it got more or less benefit than what they originally thought, and if so, then to adjust the rates or to make adjustments so that this wasn't a black hole in the bottom of the budget that sucked all the money away. So there's an ongoing review process that will be happening. Some problems with the legislation as drafted or implemented. I think the first one is that, you know, as has been said before, many taxpayers and practitioners were just unaware that this bill was here. And part of that was because it became effective in 2015, which was 2 years after the law was passed, and so there wasn't a news item to drive this thing. The public outreach was pretty minimal, and many taxpayers and even their tax professionals missed the opportunity to claim the election because they just didn't know about it. And, you know, as the law is drafted, only allowed the returns, the credit to be claimed on the original filed return. So I believe the ability to claim the reduced tax rates should be made available on amended returns if not claimed on the original return, but not the other way around. We shouldn't be able to elect out, but we should be able to elect in on an amended return. Also, as originally conceived, the amount of income subject to the reduced tax rate was to be computed with kind of a simple with and without calculation. based on Oregon taxable income. So you'd subtract the qualifying income from your Oregon taxable income and then figure out what the rates were with and without that income. The way that the Oregon Department of Revenue put the schedule together, if the qualifying pass-through income is actually greater than taxable income, it reduces the benefit, which is counterintuitive. And so there's many reasons why that can happen. You know, the taxpayer could have net operating losses, could have alimony, they could have, you know, there's all kinds of deductions on the return that didn't get into this calculation. And I believe that all those things were intended in the original legislation. In fact, I read it that way, and I just don't think that Oregon Department of Revenue, I mean, they read it a different way. I think a really simple fix there is just to limit the amount of the pass-through entity income to the Oregon taxable income. That can't be greater. You can't elect on an amount that's greater than your Oregon taxable income, and that would solve that problem. I believe that the law as written allows taxpayers to make this election on an entity-by-entity basis. That's I think, how when we talked about it, how it was going to do. The way the department implemented it was it said it was an all or nothing. You had to elect on all the qualifying entities or none of them. And I don't think that needs to be clarified legislatively by the legislature. Finally, you know, this was originally touted as a small business tax relief bill, but as has been said, it excludes the largest number of our taxpayers here in Oregon, which are the sole proprietors. And so my recommendations to the committee, respectfully, would be to allow taxpayers to amend their tax returns to elect the reduced rates, to limit the total amount of the income eligible to Oregon taxable income, to clarify whether this election is available on an entity-by-entity basis or if you have to select all of them, and to consider increasing the coverage, and if that means reducing the rates so that the overall impact of the bill is revenue neutral, I think that would be a worthwhile change to the legislation. So we spent a lot of time creating a really great single member LLC statute in Oregon, and this bill basically says you can't use it. You know, you need to become an S-corp, which is, there's all kinds of problems being an S-corp. That's why we have a single member LLC statute. But we're driving people out of that statute into S-corp because of this, and I don't think that makes any sense. So thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate the sort of diversity of opinion from you four, but, you know, there's one unanimous gist of what you said today, and that is that the legislature misfired with this bill, and it's not hitting its mark. And so I guess the policy question before us is whether we modify it, similar to what Mr. Benz laid out or what Mr. Lawrence laid out, or whether we just repeal it and say, "Oh, it just didn't work," and replace it with something that might be more effective. So do you modify it to make it better, or do you find a different way to provide tax relief for small businesses across the board? It's really the choice here. I remember Tony Van Vliet, one of the old Hall of Famers in the legislature, his one piece of advice used to be, if you see a bad bill, don't waste time trying to fix a bad bill or a bad law. Start over. And for some reason, his voice is here today. So if you could do it pound for pound and it was revenue neutral, would you suggest fixing it or finding another way to get at the intent of what we tried in 2013?
Chair Haas, in my opinion, this is, you know, having reduced tax rates on income is something we've done in other, like with farmers, we've done it with other things. I don't think that's a bad approach. It's actually the way it's not all that difficult to compute. I think there, with some minor modifications, I think this could be a very effective bill. But I do think the base needs to be broadened.
Chair Haas, I would add that it seems there is a diversity of thought or opinion as to what the intent is. If the intent relates to, in some way, stimulating or incentivizing employment, then the bill as crafted really does not do that. On the other hand, if the intent is to provide tax relief to small businesses, regardless of employment, then I think you've got a framework here that you could work with, that you could fix.
The questions of
Yes, Senator Boquist.
I want Paul to chime in here on the where we are on the, because there was, let me back up before I put Paul in here, Mr. Chair, because let me clarify for the record here once again. There's nothing here that I have heard other than CPAs advocating that their clients have their taxes increased.
Yeah.
Other than that, bluntly, there is absolutely nothing here that wasn't in the discussions, because none of you were in them, and I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how I got picked to be in them versus everybody else. But they weren't spur of the moment, like the board says. They actually, as even Chairman Hass knows, four senators on the Senate side, and we weren't involved in the House side, but on the Senate side met for almost 4 months on this. This was one of the topics. Everything that has been raised was known before we went in. And since this committee is fairly nonpartisan, I won't point fingers, but everything was known about this. Every single issue that was raised, from the no amendments, because they didn't want, various people didn't want the system gamed, because the advantage of making a mistake is you can amend it, but there's also another advantage of not doing something is you find the next year that you should have done it a different way previously, you can reach forward and back. And so they didn't want people gaming the system. Nobody wanted to give the lawyers a pay increase. I was advocating, let's just double down and raise their rate to 75% on taxes, right? And of course, there's a constitutional problem, Mr. Warner, right? So nothing in here. The one thing I do want to point out is whether, and I'm not advocating either one. I am, Mr. Chairman, you know, I am open to looking at anything and having it, but what we were trying to achieve, and it was actually stated when we brought this forward originally, was not so much, I guess you could say, job growth, and not so much relief of small business. We were trying to come up with mechanisms that would provide equity capital to a significant number of small businesses so they could use that equity capital to borrow capital for expansion and job creation in the state of Oregon. We're approaching this different, not like you create X number of jobs, but go back and say, hey, the banking laws have changed. I'm presently on a war path against the banks again. So anybody sponsoring a legislature anti-bank stuff, you need to come see me, because right now I'm ready to hang banks again as of the last couple of days. But the problem we face is that small businesses, not big corporations, but small businesses don't have access to capital, because you used to be able, as a small business, and every CPA here would tell you, if you had, you know, $100,000 or $50,000, it was easier, you know, pre-2008 to go out and get $500,000 to expand your business. But those numbers have changed now, where you might as well have the $500,000 in the bank before you're able to go out and get a loan, because you're not loaning a small business. That's how we started down this road. And so, but nothing here is something we didn't know. The question I have is, and what I have here consistently, is DOR screwed it up on the rollout. I don't know whether that's true or false. So Mr. Warner's question for me is, okay, where are we in the assessment? I mean, and if I misspoke, please correct me, Dr. Warner, because unlike everybody else here, you were in the room for all these discussions.
Senator, on our assessment of it, yes, we've been getting feedback from CPAs, practitioners, and remember, this is the first returns that in which the lower rate was eligible, came into play with a 15 tax return. So we've seen returns coming in and through April 15th, but we don't have, until we get the extended returns coming in next month, that will give us our first look on our estimates for the first year. So Chris put together estimates of what the liability would be for the 2015. So we'll get a comparison of that when we get those extended returns, and should have something for you. We may have something for you for the December committee meeting, at least a first look at it. So that'll give us an idea of how close we are. Now, there is, as was pointed out, assessment date for us in 2019, where we look and see what the actual collections were compared to what we had estimated, and then there's some percentages which could trigger a change in rates. So that would be the first time we have an actual mechanical adjustment. But by the December committee meeting, we should give you at least a pretty good look at what that first year revenue looks like compared to what we thought it would be.
All right, thanks. Other comments or discussion?
Question.
Senator Edwards.
Why was the implementation date bumped out 2 years? On this particular provision of the land bargain?
in the grand bargain, we needed money now, as Mr. Bentz said. And so it was like, okay, yeah, we agree. We need to help. Again, the issue is capitalization of debt. That's really the issue here. Okay, and if we have a better mechanism, and I could ask some questions here because I already know the answer, if the rich are getting this and everybody else isn't getting it, then we probably need to restructure. This was not a deal to put money in everybody's pocket. But the real issue, Senator Edwards, is that we needed money in that biennium for XYZ, and we knew we needed this, and everybody agreed at the table we needed it in some form, and so it came out in a sloppy form with a delayed implementation. Just the bottom line. That's true. I admit with everybody here. It does need work no matter what. We needed money.
Just a negotiation.
You're right. We needed money for education and other things now. So this got kicked down here while we did it here.
Got it.
Well, sometimes you huddle up, call a play, and the quarterback gets sacked.
I got sacked. I admit it.
Get back in the huddle, call another play. That's what you do. So. Thanks to all the CPAs for coming forward with this. Well done.
Thank you, Senator.
And this is not the last word. We'll have a committee bill, placeholder language, and go to work on this in the coming session. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will also have a committee bill on a property tax resolution, a package that may go to voters to try to clean up some of the inequities that are out there, and that is a huge lift for our legislature and for our state. So we've been talking about it. We talked about it in 2015, 2016, and we'll be talking about it again, and at some point we're going to do more than talk. But right now I'd like to call up
Mr. Chair, do you want to start off? Mr. Chair, just we have been working with an informal work group, working with Lee Oregon Cities, the assessors, Department of Revenue. And so what we thought we'd do is kind of update you where we're at, remind you of some of the discussion you had during the regular session. Kyle has put together some numbers to kind of look at where we are and start using the SGR 201, which you introduced in the short session, is kind of a template or a starting point for an overall reform package. And so Kyle will start from there and show you some more numbers. And then Benny Johnson, League of Oregon Cities, they've been heading up the work group and kind of update you where they're at in terms of that process.
Okay, Kyle.
Okay. For the record, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And as Paul was just describing, what I have today is a bit of a continuation from a discussion that we had back in the 2016 session, so back in February. And it's still based upon the SJR 201 language, which really started was a framework. It wasn't meant to be the end bill, if you will. But just to remind the committee again, the idea, the general components behind SJR 201 was to reform the property tax system or change the property tax system in. It'd be taking away the assessed value, real market value portion of Measure 50. So you'd move back to a real market value base, and then you'd still be maintaining the Measure 5 limits, the overall tax limits, and then also the tax rates for individual districts would be maintained. So the permanent rates, that structure stays, but it'd be really that real market value, assessed value distinction that goes away. Other portions of it included a requirement of the legislature to put in a homestead exemption, and then there was also language that would allow the legislature to do a real market averaging for properties in an attempt to limit, I guess, some of the up and down on the real market value. So I'll get into that at the very end, just some examples of how that averaging could work through. But what I have for you today is a continuation of some of the analysis that was presented before related to the homestead exemption, and then getting into a little bit more detail on what some of the other states do and other ways you could put in place a homestead exemption, not just directly through the property tax system, but through, say, the income tax system or something to that effect. And then I'll finish up with that, some examples of the averaging. But so the document I'm going to be referring to is in OLAS, it's labeled property tax reform. And then I also have the SJR is up there, the language as well, if you want to take a look at that. But so the document starts off as the first two pages are the same ones that you saw back in February. And that's the SJR 201 with a homestead exemption. But the homestead exemption that was presented there, the analysis that's presented there, is based upon a homestead exemption that was equal across the state. So if you put in a homestead exemption equal to 500 or 50,000 of real market value, it was 50,000 in Multnomah County, 50,000 in Baker County, Lane County, and so forth. So I can step through that really briefly, and then I'll get into a weighted approach of homestead exemption, which shows some of the differences there. But so starting on the first page, and if we just scroll down a little bit, you can see the general framework of the bar chart that I have here, and it shows the initial revenue lift. So you start off, what I did to try to highlight what the changes would look like is to superimpose the changes on the 14-15 tax year, which is still the most complete data that we have right now for the property taxes. And we'll be able to update this in a little bit for the 15-16 tax year. But you can see initially the way to read this chart is you have fiscal year 2015 overall imposed the property taxes was about $5.7 billion. You shift over to the next set of columns there, and you see this is the no measure 50 limit, so that's eliminating the assessed value distinction, going to real market value, and no homestead exemption. And the idea was there just to illustrate your initial revenue lift of shifting over to RMV. And you move up to about $6.8 billion. So it's a little over $1 billion is your initial lift. And then the next step was to put in examples of different levels of the homestead exemption. So I started at 25,000, 50,000, 75,000, and so forth. And you can see you start out at the initial lift of 6.8 billion, going to 6.5 billion, 6.2, and it tapers down as the homestead exemption ramps up. So that's the general flavor of how things work. And then the chart down below it shows a little bit of the breakdown of taxes and what class of property is paying them. So on the left side of this, if you want to go down a little bit further, thanks. You can see on the left side, you start off, the blue line refers to residential, multifamily, and manufactured structures. And you can see it's about 62%, and they'd be saying 62% of taxes imposed in fiscal year 14-15 were paid by those properties in that property class. So the residential, the multifamily, the manufactured. And that's largely residential properties making up most of that. You can see commercial properties a little below 20%, and then you have some of the other components, farm, forest, and then what I just called miscellaneous, lumping other ones together, the percentages there. And as you start, when you just shift to a real market value, you can see a little bit of the composition goes down for residential, so you shift up a little bit to the commercial just by going to real market value. And then as you put in a homestead exemption, of course, the residential piece comes down further and further as you're exempting residential properties. And it's made up for in some ways by the commercial and industrial piece starts making up more and more on a percentage basis. But that's the general flow as you move to RMV and then shift or institute a homestead exemption. And then the next set of charts I have on the next page was really showing this dynamic on a county by county basis. So this isn't specific to the county district, it's all the districts within the county. But the idea was just to show that there is variation certainly by county. And it's really primarily two factors that cause this. One is your initial lift that you get. So the distinction between assessed value and real market value differs county by county. So just moving to real market value, you get a different lift in different counties. And then as you put in a homestead exemption, that changes the flavor as well based upon more or less the homestead values in different counties. So 50,000 in Multnomah County exempt is different than 50,000 in, say, Baker County. If you put in 50,000 in Baker County, you're going to be exempting a greater percentage of the residential property tax base. But so that's these charts, and you've seen these a little bit, or seen these before, but it was so on the measure 50 eliminated, and with a homestead exemption of about 100,000, you come to about a revenue neutral. excuse me, it more or less hits about $5.7 billion again, and this is the chart in the bottom left corner there. You can see there's still a number of counties that are above the red line, which is where they are, is their tax receipts without any changes. So that's the existing status quo. And then if you're below the red line, that is a net revenue loss. And you can see there's quite a bit of variation between the counties by having that homestead exemption just being a flat amount. And then there's also the revenue lift part of it as well.
Mr. Chair, we're lost here. Hold on.
Yeah. We have a little bit of a question about whether or not we're looking at percentages or dollars on the percent of on the amount on the homestead exemption.
Scroll down so we see the top of your page. I don't think we have the same. We don't have the same thing you have.
So I'm on page 2.
No, we're on page.
And I'll get to the percentages right next.
Okay, so you're up on page 2.
I was just going through this again to highlight what was presented before. Yeah. And then, I'll get right to that. But so that's the general idea on how you read the chart. One of the things to note here, of course, is the analysis that's done on this is using real market values that are contained within the assessment systems in the counties. But one of the things that the county assessors have certainly brought up to me, and one thing I want to mention, is right now today, real market value may or may not matter too much. You still use it to test your Measure 5 limits, but in a lot of cases, the Measure 5 limits, because of where the assessed value is, may not come into play. So it's important to remember, if there was this shift period, there would probably be a period of, or a few years at least, where there'd be a high number of appeals, and there could be significant effort to go out and actually physically assess these properties rather than just using maybe a comparable sales approach and such. So it's just one of the things that I have heard from assessors on, I wanted to highlight that as well.
Senator Boquist.
So in English, you're saying the real market value might not be the real market value because it doesn't matter right now. Is that what you're saying, Kyle?
In some respects, that's maybe.
You should run for elected office in some respects, but yeah, okay, I got it.
And if one of the things we've heard is there's no distinction where we think the real market value's just high across the board or low across the board or something like that, so there's no real way to correct for that either. Most likely it would fall and even out, but certainly on a property-by-property base, there's not a whole lot of incentive right now for a property owner to appeal if it's not going to affect their taxes. And from the assessor's standpoint, whether something's assessed at $475,000 or $450,000, that's a big distinction. But if it's not going to change anything on the tax base, it may not get the same scrutiny that it will if we shift it back to RMB.
And one thing that it may come up later, and I don't want to scoop you here, but one thing that when you make this change, it eliminates those inequities that we see now where houses of the same value are paying vastly different bills and property taxes, and that's just unfair, and it's getting worse, and it's not just Portland, it's all over the state.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and that's really where you see the first, in the top left corner of the chart, you can see that red line. That's the different lifts, too, and the number one is Harney County, which is another reason why I stressed that could be related to a data issue. But you can see Hood River, Multnomah County, those ones see the greatest lift, and that's because they have the greatest variability even between counties. But definitely, if you look at some of the neighborhood maps and things that get distributed, you can see areas that have seen more growth since the late 90s have vastly different assessment ratios based on real market value. So that would be eliminated by switching to the RMB.
Kyle, when you talk to the assessors, did they allude to the fact that they probably don't have the staffing to adjust the real market values because they really haven't been paying too much attention to them over the last several years? Did they allude to that?
Yes, Senator. The assessors often will allude to staffing issues, even today, for sure. But that was one of the things I believe is this committee heard from the assessors in the interim back in, I guess, December, last December. And that was one of the things that a couple of the assessors highlighted was the number of appeals you can see has significantly gone down since pre-measure 50 days to today. So that was something they tried to highlight then they're well aware that this would probably, there'd be a little bit of a pain on their side in instituting something like this. That's
the definition of pain is.
It's probably just a result.
Of course, they won't have to do the assessed anymore. It'll just be the real. So, but as a good bureaucrat, they'll need to add staff, regardless.
All right. Well, and again, you can see there is possibility for that. There's the initial revenue lift as well. So there's some revenue there. So moving down to page 3, this is where I shifted the homestead using a weighted approach for the homestead. So rather than doing a single homestead that would be across the board statewide, the thinking was here, at least for example purposes, can use the residential improved median RMV, which is a figure that gets submitted to the Department of Revenue annually, and it's actually used for the property tax deferral program. but it is a figure that comes from the assessors. And class 101 refers to residential improved property. So it may not necessarily encompass all the properties that'd be homestead, because it wouldn't include a homestead that's sitting on a piece of farm property or something to that effect. But it gives a good indication of the differences between the counties. And you can see just right off, I've put it from high or lowest to highest, you can see just the variation, certainly from say like a Wheeler County, which is closer around the 60,000-70,000 would be the median RMV. And again, these figures are from 2014, so they're a little dated, compared to a Washington County, which is getting closer to 300,000. But so the next step was to weight the homestead exemption based upon a percentage of this residential median RMV figure. So I have the same two charts to the right here. And the start, you still get the same revenue lift. So it's the same starting point because you go two RMV, no homestead exemption. And then the next step would be saying, okay, well, what would a homestead exemption equal to 10% of this median RMV look like? And that's the first column or the first series of columns. And then I increase it to 20%, 30%, 40%, all the way to 100% exemption. So 100% of median RMV would effectively, you can think of it, that's more or less giving a homestead exemption that would eliminate property taxes for half the properties in the county, more or less. And you can see the revenue definitely begins to drop at that point. You're down to about $4.7 billion.
And, Kyle, the reason for doing that instead of a straight $100,000 or $200,000 homestead exemption, could you give us an explanation?
Yeah, the reason there, so if you look at the other chart with the Wheeler County, if you put into place a $100,000 homestead exemption, you're now above the median RMV, so you're probably talking maybe 60-70% of the tax base, at least on the residential side, is gone or is exempt. So it would disproportionately affect, say, Wheeler County to, say, Washington or Hood River, one of those. And even another way to look at it is you're giving it less of effect to a homeowner in one of these higher value counties, where if you give them a $50,000 homestead exemption, that's different than, rather than eliminating 60% of their taxes they owe, it could be something more like 15%. So it'd be a way to equalize it a little bit to the homeowner.
How would you keep that rolling forward in, you know, 10 years from now when, you know, demographics and economy shift?
Yeah, Senator, that's in doing kind of this static one-year example, that would be one of the sticking points is how to, you could definitely make it a static point or index it in some way, would allow it to grow with, say, overall real market values of the class of properties or something to that effect, to make sure if you're the goal is to keep it more or less proportionate in 10 years, you can either build in a mechanism that would allow it to index, or it could be one of those things that does get revisited. I mean, the idea with SJR 201, the way it was set up, the constitutional change is going to real market value, and then is the legislature what was providing that homestead exemption. And part of that reasoning is to allow that flexibility. If you put it in the Constitution, it's a little bit more difficult to correct for some of the another inequity that pops up in 10 years.
I think that is something that we need to work on, because that starts to get tricky. I like the idea of 100,000. It's easy for taxpayers to understand they're going to need 100,000, you know, exempt or 200,000. And I understand this would have a huge revenue hit in some of those smaller counties with properties or less, but I think it'd be easier, just one person speaking, for the state to make those counties whole than it would be to overly complicate a system where taxpayers don't understand it, and if they don't understand it, they're going to vote no on this. And part of this exercise has to be keeping it simple enough for voters to understand so that they can approve it, because we don't have any changes it collapses on its own.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, that actually segues pretty well to the next. Well, I have, I guess, skipping through really briefly the different county effects, you can see that this weighting does tighten it a bit. But going on to page 5, I'm trying to highlight what some of the other states do, and then also how this could be, you could institute a homestead exemption rather than even using the property tax system, you could do it through the income tax system. If it depends, the burden or the tax loss, of course, is going to hit the general fund in that case if you offer, say, a refundable credit on the personal income tax system. But that would be a way you could still compute it based upon the 100,000, to use your example, 100,000 homestead exemption. It'd still be computed the same way based upon your property value, but the tax benefit would come through the income tax system. One of the, if it is an issue there, would be, from the homeowner perspective, there's a timing issue. So you pay your property taxes in November, you file your property or your income tax return maybe February or spring, so you would be getting the tax benefit maybe a little bit later in the year. So you have to pay in November, and then you don't get the refundable credit back or the benefit until the spring. Now there's definitely ways to adjust withholding and everything, but it would be dependent upon the individual. What their circumstances are on the personal income tax side, of course.
Senator Bertschinger.
But if you don't have taxable income, you won't benefit from it.
Right, Senator, and that's where you'd have to make it a refundable credit. And the downside there would be if there's individuals that don't have to file today to receive this refundable credit, they would have to file. Or you could always set up just a payment system as well, but you wouldn't be taking advantage of the existing structure of the income tax system. So you could just cut a check as well.
Just when you thought it got complicated, it got more complicated.
And again, these are just examples being presented to get the thoughts rolling, I guess. They're not meant to convey any policy option that the legislature, and this is more of the people behind me, the legislature is considering, of course.
Senator Buckwist.
Just so I understand the concept of the personal income tax version of doing that, you're basically you're transferring it to the state, and you wouldn't necessarily need to hold the counties. You wouldn't need the notion of holding the counties whole, as you said, Chairman Hass. You wouldn't have to do, because the state would absorb both sides of the coin here, so to speak. Is that not correct?
Yes, Senator.
So instead of having giving money out to the counties, still get the same, see the same revenue XYZ, you know, if not increased revenue, and the state, you don't have to go out to Wheeler County and do anything. It's the state who does it internally, and it's all handled internally within the state.
Yes, exactly. That would be, it actually, yeah, you'd see the revenue lift from moving to RMV at the local government level.
Right.
And then the state would see, there would be some in the lift on the K-12 side. Of course, you'd have more money coming in on the K-12 side at the local level. So that will offset, in a way, what the state would have to send back to the state school fund. So it's not a one-to-one, but there is some of that offsetting. So there'd be more coming in that way. You can almost think that the dollars don't actually come into the general fund, but it's less the general fund would have to send out immediately to hold K-12 at the exact same spot.
That's a good point, Senator Boquist. Mm-hmm. But as Senator Bertschinger points out, that's another layer of complexity.
That's hard to get on a referral.
Right, I understand, but I'm only saying the complexity is then limited to the state versus 36 counties, so on and so forth. So it's all very complex. It's just less complex of being very complex, which is why we have these tough decisions.
Right, and just to, I guess, add one more level of complexity, mm-hmm. and this is in the existing system, but it is probably important to keep in mind, is for those that itemize on the personal income tax side, an itemized deduction is the property taxes they pay. So if you provide a homestead exemption and you decrease property taxes paid on the property side, it will flow through on the income tax side and actually lead to a slight increase at their federal and state taxable income. So just an important thing to keep in mind. If you're thinking the tax benefit to the homeowner is $1,000, say, that may be more like $800 after they pay their income taxes. But again, it depends upon the specific homeowner. But so that's a walkthrough on the homestead exemption. I do have a listing of some of the policies in other states. A number of other states do use homestead exemptions. In many cases, they're age-based focused. A lot of times you see these used at the elderly side. Some are more broad. Oregon does actually have a homestead exemption, an existing one. It's the disabled vets homestead exemption. There's a couple others that are smaller as well. But when you look at what other states are doing, and we actually have our intern Jake is looking at some of the other states are doing, you do see a lot of these homestead exemption programs, but in many cases they may be pretty isolated or a smaller subset. Circuit breakers, of course, are out there as well. That's a circuit breaker. The general idea is you're looking at property taxes as a percentage of an individual's income, and you limit it in some way when it hits a percentage of their income. I have assessment and tax ratios listed there, as that's another way that you could tweak the system, is you can change assessment ratios based on owner-occupied property versus non, or something to that effect. And then the last bullet I have there is a property tax credit. And rather than thinking from an exemption standpoint, you can actually think of a property tax credit. So when an individual goes to pay their bill, say they owe $3,000, and they get a homestead exemption that's equal to $1,000. When they go to pay their bill in November, rather than paying $3,000, they pay $2,000. But you don't actually exempt the underlying property, which doesn't change, not to get in the weeds too much, it doesn't change the way in which the tax funds are distributed. So it would minimize some of the differences between districts. You'd still have the county by county issue. But one of the things that's been highlighted in some of the discussions with the League of Oregon Cities is that if you have certain districts that are more composed of residential property, they could be affected more because their tax base would be more limited by homestead exemption than other taxing districts. And so what you see in the charts showing the different effects in the counties could be heightened at the even district-by-district level. You would see some of that, how the chips fall. So a property tax credit could be a way to work around, at least on the district issues. But it's something that, for discussion, I guess, or continued discussion. And then just the last piece I have on the last page is just showing some of this averaging of the real market value. And there's, again, the bill just allows the legislature to do this, so there's nothing specified. So what I did was just using a three-year average. So the value of, say, a property in 2016 would be the average of the 2016, the 2015, and the 2014 value. And I chose five counties out of here just to display that they're, again, when you try to come up with one policy and you have the 36 counties, you can get multiple results on how it flows through. With the idea being, if you see just constant growth or continued growth when, say, like a Multnomah County, you can see the averaged approach is lagging behind the actual real market value. So there is a little bit of a benefit there. But in other cases, in, say, a Clatsop County, which is at the top there, you can see in the beginning in 2014, the averaged of the previous 3 years would actually result in higher RMV than what the actual is, because it's catching up with what's come down previously and then gone back up. And again, this isn't necessarily a representative sample of the 36 counties, but is more meant to highlight some of the differences that can come up by what's going on in individual counties. But those are the examples I have for you today. And again, this is kind of a continuation of some of the discussion from February. And,
Kyle, this is an excellent presentation. I appreciate for the first time seeing those homestead exemptions broken down like that. Questions for Kyle? Okay, sir, stand by. Wendy Johnson.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. So this is my first time seeing the presentation as well, so now I'm going to have to recoup because I think Kyle stole a lot of the thunder here. I just wanted to bring you up to date for where the League has been since we adjourned session. The property tax issue has been, of course, a League priority for a number of years. So after the session, we have our regular committee meetings. And we have several, like 7 or 8 committees. One is the Finance and Tax Committee. So they met in March, April, and May. And again, after discussing all the finance and revenue issues for our cities, and these are electeds as well as staff that participate on these committees, the number one priority again was property tax reform. So what we do is we take all of the committee's recommendations and put it out to a ballot to all 241 cities. And so in July, that went out, and then we got the results. Property tax, transportation were the top two vote getters of what are the priorities that need to be fixed for cities. So, and the board of directors then confirmed that priority of property tax reform. Why? Well, I think you've heard us say before, 60% of a city's budget or more is based on property tax. It's our number one revenue. Why also for schools, it's a third of their budget is property taxes. And for special districts, it's the primary revenue source. So that includes transit districts. And since transportation was number one, most transit districts can't get any more revenue either because of the system we have. Property taxes brought in $5.5 billion in the last year, and it's going up a little bit, but we're really stuck of where we're at, and we can't adjust even locally. So that's the why. But what is the League's priority this time? It's a little bit different. You've heard the League's priorities for the last three sessions. They were usually in three topics: change property ratio, reset at sale, and local options outside of compression. We've decided not to do, and those are specific fixes. They're one subject. The reason for that is that's all we can constitutionally do is one fix to the Constitution. Those don't poll well because they only help a particular set of facts. And so there's definite winners and losers, and they don't really help the whole system. They don't address the inequity problem at all. And it does for some, but not many. So this time the League's priority is we want the system fixed. Comprehensive reform is what we think the voters want. It's been 25 years and almost 20 years. Measure 5 is 25 years old, and Measure 50 is almost 20. It just doesn't work anymore. It started out working okay, but it just doesn't anymore. So, Senator Haas, you mentioned at the very beginning, sometimes you can fix a bad bill, but usually you just need to start all over. That's kind of where we're at. I don't think any of us wanted to be there, because it's really hard to start all over. But that's what the league priority now has been revised. The details were much more flexible on them, because we know that politically it has to pass the legislature and it has to pass through the voters. So the details we're not as concerned about as we were before. We just want the system to work and provide local options, local choices, and get rid of the inequities that we have. So we're much more flexible. I just want to make sure that you're aware that if you revise the Constitution to do more than one subject, it's called a constitutional revision. That requires a two-thirds vote from the legislature, and then it has to go to the voters. So it is a big lift, and we know that we all have to be on board, because that's a huge, huge vote count to get. So it has to be something that will work across the state. The League's Finance and Tax Committee also recommended that, not just saying that's what we want as our priority, they said we need to put the manpower behind it and do our own work group, if that's feasible, because this committee had SJR 201. That was a great start. It had the two components, but it didn't have the rest of the details, and everybody knew it was just a starting point. So who's going to do the work? So we decided that if that was feasible, we should really work on it. So we, the board supported that as well, went to Legislative Revenue Office to see if they would support that. They not only supported it, but said they would participate and help us run the numbers. So in July, we started a work group. We formed that work group in June. That work group has two assessors, two finance directors, two folks from your LRO staff, Paul and Kyle, and a representative each from the Department of Revenue's property tax section and the governor's office. So it's a group of nine, and then I staff that work group, and we're working on the nitty-gritty details. It's difficult. it's a lot of details to try to figure out of 25 years worth of changes, and every county, city, and special district has a different set of facts. And so it's just hard. We met in July, we met in August, we'll meet again. We hope to meet in September, but it's looking tough since last week was City Hall week. This week is Ledge Days, and next week is the League's annual conference where property tax will be talked about again a lot. We gave the work group direction of start with SJR 201, the two parts of return to RMV, and to provide a homestead exemption. But neither of those were really fleshed out in SJR 201, what that RMV switch would look like and what the homestead exemption would look like. So we're working on that in the work group. But we're hoping to get the rest of those details put together. In addition to SJR 201, we're also using this committee's the first report you received in December from Legislative Revenue Office on the options for restructuring state and local revenue system, that long report that had the different options that included changing income taxes, changing the earned income credit, changing gross receipts and property tax, that longer report. We're using that as well, because it's pretty insightful on how you, when you change the property tax system, what the economic effects are. So we're using that as well. The system we have now is a rate-based system. The system we had before Measure 50 was a levy-based system. The assessors, I think it's fair to say on the committee, think that we should go back to a levy-based system. This rate-based system just hasn't worked well. There are pluses and minuses with each system. I know that there's negative opinion from some in this building on the levy-based system, and we agree that there were problems with the old system. So that was one of the initial issues that our work group has been struggling with. Which system do we use? So at this point, we haven't made a decision. We're working on rewriting both. If we had to keep the rate system, how would we do it to make it work? And if we went back to a levy-based system, how would we do that? I'm not sure how familiar this committee is with the levy-based system, but with a levy-based, you start with a budget that's passed or will be recommended, and then you divide it out with amongst the taxpayers to make that budget meet. So it's not a rate per assessed value. It's you divide it out based on the budget pot. So if you give a homestead exemption, it's lowering how much your share will be, but it's shifting it to the other taxpayers. But you don't have a decrease that needs to be filled like would be done with a rate-based system. That's kind of the big picture. So in addition to that initial issue of do we do a levy system or do we do a rate system, Dr. Warner asked me to also kind of explain some of the specific issues we're dealing with. The first is how should the property be assessed? You've already given us direction with SGR 201. Get rid of this assessed value MEV concept and go to real market value. We're literally the only state that is so divorced from the reality of what property is based on and what everybody knows of my real market value, what can I sell it for? Excuse me. That we need to get back to that reality to fix the inequities. That's the house pictures, the two houses on the same street that are worth the same that have totally different property values. The only way we're going to fix that is to go back to real market value. So that's a no-brainer, but some of the details are, do we do an average? How do we phase it in? And so we're working on those parts of it. The second specific issue we're dealing with is the homestead exemption, and I think Kyle did a great job of explaining the issues there. I think our cities in particular are really concerned about a one-size-fits-all. I agree with Senator Haas, it would be nice if everybody could say, okay, I get to take $100,000 off that won't be taxed, but it has such a disparate impact across the state that we're a little uncomfortable with that. We're looking more at recommending a percentage of RMV that's capped, or a percentage of RMV that's capped plus a minimum that would be like a county average of what the RMV is, so that there would be some minimum that you would know that you're going to get at least that much, and it would be capped. But that would address some of the disparate impact. And we're also just concerned that to make that homestead exemption really work, you have to have revenue to backfill. And if you have it less discrepancies across the state, we don't have to worry about that issue over time as much. So we're working on the homestead exemption details of how much it should be and how we'd probably phase it in as well along with the RMV. Then the next big issue is the permanent rates. If we keep a rate system and a levy system, the permanent rates is really our hardest topic, I think. Rates, as you know, were frozen in 1997, and they're all over the board. We have some counties and some cities that are at zero as their permanent rate. Some are over 10. The average is around 3. And almost all of these areas have totally changed in what services they're provided, what revenues are available. I mean, these were written before the timber payments went away. We've had water and sewer and fire changes that are all over the state. So these rates just don't make sense. But how do we adjust them? The Constitution says they're frozen. And how do we equalize it when the facts of each city and county and special district are totally different of what their needs are, what their services are? So that's why I think the assessors are really leaning towards the levy, the budget based, rather than the rate based, because trying to adjust those, you could do a one-time adjustment, you could do a CPI, or some sort of indexing on the rates, but none of those really get at the problem that we have of locals can't decide how to efficiently provide services. More and more special districts are proliferating because those districts don't have a rate, so they can get a new one, but then they're all competing against each other of the same rate. So that's the part we'll work on at our next meeting of how to recommend fixing the rate system, but it's really difficult. On the base for the levy system, if we go that route, the group is leaning towards suggesting use the July budget of that year, and then having some sort of a automatic increase, but then also a CPI, and then include new property as it's added in to increase your base, and also adding population to increase your base. So there needs to be some way. If you start with one budget, you're going to have needs over time. So how do you increase that budget and allow for that levy? And if your city's growing, you're going to need a bigger base as well. So we'll use some numbers in there. We need limits too. That's the next hardest part of. So that's really why we had the revolt with Measure 5 and 50, is that the voters didn't want to see their property taxes continue to escalate. But the Measure 5 limits don't work. We have almost all schools in compression, 60% of cities in compression, and over 80% of counties in compression. So that means they have hit the max of Measure 5. So we have to change those, and we know we need to put some kind of limit back in. And there are two options. The Measure 5 was the total on RMV, and then you had for Measure 50, you had the 3% growth limit, but that was on AV. We think we need one or the other, some type of limit, but it depends on which system we go with. as a recommendation, but we recognize that the voters will expect to see some limit, but we also need to have exceptions. Right now, the system we have with no exceptions doesn't allow voters to make a choice, doesn't allow for emergency situations of needing a new water system, needing a fire system, when before it was volunteers. I mean, we just don't have any exceptions. So we recognize we need a limit with some exceptions, and we're still working on those details. So those are the main components of any property tax system. You know, what are you going to assess? What's going to be the rate or the base? What are the limits? And then the homestead exemption. Then some other specific issues that we need to deal with that are also tricky are urban renewal. If it's a levy system, then everybody else pays more to get the budget. And so that, you know, was a criticism before. So we need to figure out how to do that. If we do a levy system with a rate system, it's a little easier on urban renewal. We need to deal with the renter issue. If you do a homestead exemption, it really only helps the you know, primary homeowner. It doesn't help renters, and that will be a pushback. We know there are some other options to do there. Schools and community colleges, a third of their budget, as I said, is from property taxes. They've hit the $5 cap, but then they've got the equalization formula that makes this complicated, and so we know we need to deal with that separately. And then there's some specific issues for businesses, the personal property, intangibles, and the 140-plus exemptions. Those are levers that you can use to help pay for this if you need to politically, or you can expand those. I mean, those exemptions are always part of the package of property tax reform. And then transitions are tricky. How do we deal with those? We'll need to deal with those. And then lastly, the assessor situation, which was brought up in the last presentation from Kyle. I spoke at the assessor's conference in August, and I think that I learned a couple of big things. That they don't like the system at all either. They hate it when the property tax bills go out and they have the line out the door of, you know, people complaining of why my taxes are this much and my neighbors are this. They want it fixed, but they also recognize that if we fix it, it will be more work for them, because right now they don't have to assess RMV because they're just using the AV and doing a 3% on the inequitable situation. So we know that we need to fix how assessors are how we fund assessors, and that because that formula just hasn't worked for years. Every time we do a new exemption, as you know from this committee, the assessors want a fee because they can't pay for what they've got now. I also learned that there's some new and improved property that could be bringing in money for all of our taxing jurisdictions if we had the funds to pay the assessors to do it, but they don't have the funds to even do what we've got now. So we recognize that we need to fix that system as well as part of this reform, because it will take more resources from the assessor side. As I said, our next meeting will focus on the rate system. We think timing is everything. We know this is a huge lift. We're hopeful to have something ready for you for next session should the opportunity present itself. But this whole revamping with the homestead exemption and backfilling only works if you have new revenue. And we know there's a budget shortfall as well. So we know that this is the timing is everything kind of thing. We know there's a coalition of folks who would like to see this besides the league. And the business community and even the realtors recognize that our system isn't working great with the, you know, as a revenue as a whole. So once we have something ready, we'll share it with our other interest groups and keep working on how to tweak it. But we want to have something for you. I think everybody recognizes it's broken, it's not fair, and it's not sustainable if we want to pay for infrastructure, pay for services. This just doesn't work. Again, I thank you for the opportunity and the team that we've put together, and Dr. Warner's staff has been just incredible. It's not an easy lift, and I just thank you for your time.
Thank you for your presentation. I appreciate you kind of moving back to square one and looking at a more comprehensive picture, and I appreciate your flexibility, because if we were to get the votes up here, the necessary votes on the floors of the House and Senate, and if we were able to get a positive vote statewide, it still won't fix every single thing in the property tax system, many of which you enumerate, especially if we try to keep it a simple, basic fix. It's maybe 80% of the issues that So I appreciate that. Any questions for the lead? Senator Burchard.
Just comment. Have we reached out to the proponents of Measure 5 and Measure 50?
Funny you should mention that, because I was going to note that whenever we talk about this property tax fix, we always have to invoke the grandfather of the property tax revolution, Don McIntyre, who has since passed, but 4 or 5 years ago came before this committee and advocated for repealing the Measure 50 language. Yeah.
But I believe they should be, you know, we should reach out to them, because we go through all this and get a referral out there and it's labeled as a tax increase, then it's just been all a waste of time and it's not going to happen. So I think it would be very prudent for us to reach out to those folks.
Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. About the levy system, the way I understand that is you set a budget and then collect taxes to pay for that budget based on a budget that's set. Of course, the Oregon Constitution says that that's how the legislature is supposed to do it, and we don't. But I'm just wondering if you think, you know, you're going to get a huge pushback from that with people saying, you need to set your budget based on what money you get, as opposed to setting your budget and then going after the money. I mean, as I say, our Oregon Constitution says that the legislature is supposed to set a budget and then collect the taxes to pay for that budget, but we don't do it that way. So I wonder what your comments are about that.
Sure. Chair Haas, Senator Riley, I mean, I get the pushback, but cities are providing water, sewer, police. That's their primary things. And those, you know what those costs are ahead of time, and our Constitution also and statute requires a whole open hearings budget process to set that budget. Mm-hmm. So that's where the people get to weigh in on whether that budget's set right. And as I said, we would put limits on how much that budget can increase if we would go back to a levy system to address that very problem. And if you're going to do an increase, the voters can speak with that.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Just an observation, you know, for the cities, and I think I'm speaking to you guys next week anyway, but one of the challenges with reforming, whether it's levy or whether it's rate or so on and so forth, and you say the citizens weigh in, the unfortunate situation is how we got to where we are is the citizens didn't think they were part of the process, because many cities, counties, government agencies, special districts, and especially the legislature, knock on wood, as Senator Riley said, don't necessarily follow the Constitution sometimes, and sometimes work in the dark. Grand bargain, right? So you can get the chair to nod his head here, okay? And so that's one of the problems we have is the perception, because I think most people that I've found, even in my cities that I have in my district who have rejected, you know, tax increases or bonds or so on and so forth, will pay for the basic list you said earlier. It's just all this other stuff that magically happens, and then they get mad, and they don't think they were part of the process. And, you know, if you think it's complex to figure out what we might do if you change to a levy system, which I'm not even sure, you lost me completely, but that's okay, that's going to be even more complex to convince the voter. So the one thing that the one ask is, you know, we are facing this on the Transportation Committee, those that are on it, and that is the cities and counties and other entities may or may not have been able to do something, and so they come and they want us to do what they could not do. This will only work. Am I correct here?
Yeah.
You're on the committee.
Oh, yeah.
This will only work, a reform will only work if the cities, the counties, all the special districts, the legislature, and everybody is working together to say, okay, this is a better way to do it. This actually, in the long run, is more cost effective.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. We've got a few more things on the agenda. I would recommend that we take a 5-minute break and reconvene at 9:40. Okay?
Well.
We have Mazen here to help us with the annual revenue, transportation revenue forecast. So I will turn it over to Mazen Malik.
Okay. Chair Haas and Senators, transportation revenue forecast is done by ODOT, Office of Finance and Revenue, well, Finance, and they have been going through a change in the forecast methodology and an update of that forecast methodology. And accordingly, things are looking different at this time. So we thought it's probably a great opportunity with all the side talks about the transportation issues and so on, that you start getting a look at the changes that you probably be seeing more full-fledged in about a year or so once they're done with all these changes. So we asked Dan Porter, who's ODOT economist, who's doing that upgrade at this time, to come and share with you their latest forecast and what kind of changes that they've done with it. So he would go through these slides, and he will probably also mention and explain where changes have been done and going through, and especially in the forecast arena. So,
Mr. Porter, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Porter. As Madison said, I'm an economist with the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I'm here to going to give you a rather overview of our most recent state highway fund revenue forecast. Since this is our first time kind of before this committee, I thought we would kind of give you more of a broader overview, talk you through like what are the major sources are of revenue, then kind of get into what are the main drivers, what's affecting transportation revenues, and then kind of give you an overview of where we're at with our forecast. So you can kind of sum up our revenues into three kind of distinct categories. It's our motor fuels taxes, our motor carrier fees and taxes, and then our DMV. And motor fuels, that's our gas tax that we pay, and our diesel tax and other use fuel tax that are predominantly on vehicles that are 26,000 pounds and under. So it's our cars and light trucks, plus the kind of the delivery type trucks that are over 10,000 pounds, but are 26,000 pounds under. So they pay a tax at the retail station. And then when the bigger trucks, when you get above 26,000 pounds, that puts you into our motor carrier division. Motor carrier has a weight mile tax instead of a fuels tax. And so that's the rate you pay is based on the weight of the vehicle and the axles that you have on your truck. And then that's multiplied by the number of miles you drive on a trip, and that gives you your bill for that trip. And then they also do the registrations for those heavy trucks as well. And then DMV, of course, is our main touch point with the Oregonians, and it's where you go in and we get certified to be safely drive on the highways as individuals, through the licensing and getting endorsements to do commercial driving or motorcycles. Plus, it's taking our vehicles, right? So it's our getting our titles for legal ownership, and then the registrations is giving us access to the network. So motor fuels is our biggest piece. About 44% of our gross revenues is the motor fuels piece, and then the other two, DMV and motor care, about 28% each. If you think of it in terms of like a user taxes versus access fees, the user taxes being the more you use it, the more you pay, which is the motor carrier weight mile piece and the motor fuels. That's about 2/3 of our taxes revenues are those. And then about 1/3 is sort of the access piece of it, about the registrations and the titles and the licensing part of it.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
I just want to, you're the economist, so you're the first one I got. So I'll see your comrades back there scribbling quickly when I start talking. And then Senator Edwards will probably jump in, no doubt. Right after this. The 4428, right, that's the present constitutional balance, roughly. Is that not correct?
Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, you're talking about like the distribution?
Check.
The distribution formulas are, there's different ones depending on different legislation. It works out to be pretty close to a 50-30-20 split. Or 50% is ODOT, 30% counties, 20% cities.
No, that's not what you mean? Category. Under the Constitution, Mazen, jump in here because you raised this issue in the last 48 hours. Under what I'm trying to grasp here is that this 4428, under the Constitution, the gasoline-driven cars, light vehicles, have to pay their proportionate share to heavy vehicles.
And as an economist, and these, when you come down, and I'm alerting you because I already skimmed through it, you're doing these charts, what I'm looking to see is what changes we would have to do statutorily in order to keep us in constitutional balance between the 44-28. Are you tracking now?
Yes.
Okay. Committee's probably completely lost, but Mazen will catch them up.
So, Chair Hatch, Senator Bilquist, he's talking about the highway cost allocation splits. That Constitution requires what we come up with is what we spend on lights, there needs to be a proportional side on the heavies, and it ends up, it's about 65-35 right now based on the 2015 study. And it's updated every 2 years, and they're updating one now that'll be presented to you in probably somewhere February or so of next year.
Thanks.
Okay, so those are our sources, and just really quickly kind of work through the method. We have a methodology that's very similar to what DAS's Office of Economic Analysis has in terms of the modeling piece of it. We're using historical data to help drive the forecasts for our different sources. So the gallons that we've consumed in the past, plus information that shows us that certain variables help predict the future, we use that data to predict what's going to happen in the future. So that's that data-driven piece. We're consistent with DAS in that. So when Josh and Mark were up here last week talking to you, they were giving their forecast. We'll take the outputs from their forecast plus the macro data as inputs into our forecast. So we're consistently using the same information so that we're all kind of talking, we can see the same things happen, and we can talk back to each other about what's going on in the state. And we publish ours twice a year versus quarterly, which is what they do, right? So ours is on a June-December cycle, whereas theirs is every quarter. So this forecast I'm giving you right now is our June forecast, and then we'll start working on our December forecast in November. So looking at what impacts our transportation revenues, you've got three different kind of broad categories. So you've got this population piece, which is like not only total population, but it's certain cohorts, age cohorts, impact certain pieces. So a permit is looking specifically at generally that 15 to 17 age cohort, and how many people are going to be in there in the future determines generally how many of those permits might be sold. So you have the population piece, the economic piece is really, and population piece specifically is really strong in DMV, which is, again, really tied to kind of the demographics, not as much as the economy. And then the economic piece is really strong in our motor carrier and motor fuels, which are, again, more of those user taxes pieces of it. So as the system, your demand of the use of the system is in part driven by, a large part driven by the economy. And then lastly, so I'll policy changes and how that can impact our revenues. And I'm going to go through now just sort of some the major ones that are impacting it now or what we're seeing through these different categories. So I'll give you a population one first. This is kind of my favorite one right now. This is out-of-state centered licenses. So as a person moves in from another state into Oregon, say they come from California into Oregon, and they go into DMV, they turn in their license from California, and they're going to get an Oregon license. And so this is kind of our first sort of touch point with the individual. And when they do that, they're going to be getting potentially a number of different services. They're getting a new Oregon license. They're probably bringing in a vehicle or vehicles, which they'll have to register and title. They might have another endorsement. So they might get a motorcycle endorsement or a commercial endorsement. So they're potentially using a number of DMV services. So what we have here in this chart is the black line is kind of the actuals, the history here. And then I've given you the last four forecasts. And as you can see, I'm missing in these forecasts. And that each time expected that we were kind of peaking and then we would have a dip into sort of a long run sort of growth average. And this last one particularly has been missed again. And then now the last forecast is getting us close to almost 100,000 people by the end of, that's an annual number, then by the end of 2016, surrendering their license in Oregon, which is, that's just individuals turning in their license, that's not total population. So that's creating potentially a pretty significant increase in a number of people using our system. That doesn't say anything about where they're moving to, although we have some other data that kind of suggests that they'll predominantly moving to the Valley and into the Portland area, which just makes sense given where congestion has been going. So the question is, where is this? Have we peaked? Are we going to keep growing? It based on what we're seeing is that this is probably about the peak. 2016 was with employment growth sort of supposedly peaking at right about now. We just see this dropping off going into the future, and we just say this slowing down. So then moving into sort of the economic piece, the big number one economic driver that sort of covers all of our sources is total non-farm employment. So this is all non-agricultural employment. It influences some DMV's transactions as well as really significant in the motor fuels and then in the motor carrier as well. I know that you've seen this kind of chart before, and you can clearly see the recession in 2001, the big recession in 2009, and then this increase coming out of that. And where we are right now is, again, at this sort of peak growth of employment, and then we're expecting to see this drop, slowing growth coming out of that. And in the outer years, you're getting to growth rates of less than 1% of the forecast, which has, a significant impact then on some of our particularly motor fuels forecast. Another one is gasoline prices. So this is the change in the real average gasoline price at the national level. And one thing that you can see is very volatile, right? Fuel prices are very volatile. They move up and down for a whole host of reasons, some of them real, some of them imagined. And you can see, you can still see the recession effects, specific to 2009, where demand decreased, and so prices decreased as well. And then that rapid increase coming out of that. And so for Oregon, we saw elevated gas prices through the summer of 2014 before we started seeing a decline in the fall of 2014 and then really declines in the 2015 and into this year as well. So in this forecast, which is what we use in our model, the expected growth is supposed to – we're seeing growth in prices again beyond 2017. So we're supposed to see prices remain pretty constant through 2017 and then growth beyond that. There's a lot of reasons why that might be wrong. It is what we have, but the supplies right now are well excess of historical averages. And the theory is that we'll see drawdowns starting in middle of 2017. Then as supply, then this capacity gets a little tighter, then prices will start to increase. But you can make the argument that if that happens and the prices start to increase, there's also a lot of supply that's just sitting out there waiting to be drilled. And so that could increase, push up the amount that's being supplied. So, and if the economy is slowing down, then demand, you would think, would decrease some too. So there's a lot of issues going on with this price forecast. And then there's OPEC and what they might do and or not do. And it's why fuel price forecasting is very difficult, but it is what we're using now. The good news about fuels is that it's a fuel price. While it's important, it's not necessarily an extremely significant variable in like a motor fuels model, because when we drive, we're usually driving to do something. We're not driving just to drive itself. So the price of fuel, while it affects our disposable income or maybe make us have a tighter budget at which to operate from, it's not necessarily going to impact whether or not we go to work or not. If we have a job, will impact more our driving habits than the price of fuel will. And that's what we've been seeing in history. Another variable, and this one I show you because this is particularly important in the weight mile model, is our real consumer expenditures on durable goods. So durable goods are like the goods that are supposed to have a shelf life of several years, like your TVs and washing machines, those kind of things that are shipped by truck generally, or maybe it comes in on a container and then it's put on a truck, go to a distribution center to a retail station, or something like that. But these are coming from a truck to a certain location, and it's a good predictor of what we're seeing in weight mile revenue. So the expectation for now is that as employment growth is strong and incomes are coming back too, we expect to see a little bit of increase in like 2017, but then a pretty sharp drop or slowing growth in the future, but positive. So what we can get from weight mile is that it's going to see a little increase, and then it's going to slow down but remain positive and pretty steady in the out years of the forecast. And then, that was the last one on economy. Then I'll give you an example on the policy piece. This is fuel efficiency of the light vehicle stock. So stock is all the vehicles. So it's sort of the average fuel economy of vehicles of like 10,000 pounds and under. So it's our cars and light trucks. And as you can see, from about 1990 through pretty much all the 2000s, there really wasn't much change in the fuel economy. So the mile that you drove before consumed the same amount of gas in 1990 as it did about 2010. When Congress passed a law in 2007 increasing these CAFE standards, beginning on model year 2012 through model year 2016 vehicles, kind of the expectation is to ramp it up about 5% a year in fuel efficiency for new vehicles. And that was kind of a phase one. And then a phase two gets you 2017 through 2025, where it's overall about a 60% increase on top of that to get you from about 28 miles per gallon for a new vehicle in 2012 to 54.5 miles per gallon in a new vehicle by 2025. That's not on road. The on road is supposed to be more like about 38 by 2025, but still, it's a very significant increase in fuel efficiency, and we're seeing that. So the little red dotted line is what we're seeing from the Oregon data. And that's measured by, we have our DMV has all the registrations, so taking all the registration data and matching it up with the EPA's combined rating for their fuel efficiency, and then just taking an average of it. So it's not capturing every vehicle, but it is capturing most of the vehicles. And while it doesn't tell you what our on-road use is, it is telling us that our fleet overall is getting more fuel efficient. So from 2018, which is our 2008 when we first had the data, to 2015, we've increased steadily in the last few years of about 1.5% per year as a fleet. So we expect that to continue as these CAFE standards get implemented, and these things will push beyond 2025 because the fleet takes so long to turn over because these are on new vehicles.
Senator Boquist, did you have a question?
I just want you to clarify and jump on your boss's bandwagon. So, I'm predicating here, so I'm giving it out here so you know what to say here. I was surprised, colleagues on the transportation side, when we started looking at this, because the first thing many of us think is the Prius, the electric car, so on and so forth. These standards, I mean, the first response you got at DMV and ODOT is really we're talking about the F-Ford 51, the 150 truck. I mean, the number of vehicles across the board that are going up is not proportionate to the notion that it's a Prius or it's an electric car or something else. It is actually larger, heavier cars.
Conventional cars that are getting better gas mileage.
Getting better gas mileage. And this is what makes the significant change. Because, yes, not everybody drives electric Prius, so on and so forth. But that is it's pretty stunning to look at the numbers and what is happening. Because, of course, the F-150 is not getting any lighter. Am I?
Yeah, sure, Hassan Rokas. You're right. They have to increase efficiency of all of these vehicles because there's a lot of the sales are in these lower MPG vehicles. But it's F-150 today at low 20s is a lot better than F-150 in the teens before. So, and if they move to like aluminum body frames and that kind of thing, they can significantly reduce the weight and increase efficiency even more. So it's not electric. So we have about 6,000 electric vehicles right now registered in the state. That's of 3.4 total million vehicles. That's a very small amount. But increasing. So I bring this slide up particularly because what it does is have a profound impact on motor fuels model, because now you can drive the same mile with less fuel than you could drive before. So what it does is have this impact on our motor fuels forecast. So what we're showing you here is that look from 1990 through about 2006, we kind of have this pretty steadily increase in fuel consumption. And then we have, heading into the recession, this decline. And then we had a decline continuing as we struggled to recover from the recession. And the fuel efficiency started to take off. Right now, we're seeing great, strong growth in motor fuels. So the growth right now, we're on pace for about 5.2% for the year. But that, like I said, it makes sense because our employment growth is over 3% right now, too. And employment is really strongly tied to this consumption piece. But what's being hidden is this fuel efficiency piece. And as employment growth really slows in these out years of the forecast and it gets below 1%, and you have an increases in fuel prices as well, then this fuel efficiency effect, which is kind of consistently around 2%, expected to be around 2% per year, starts to override what we're seeing in these employment driver. And so it's actually pulling down, kind of for the first time we're showing this effect, is it pulling down the motor fuels forecast. And since it's the biggest share of our total gross revenues, this has a pretty profound impact on the overall forecast. So looking at kind of the components of each one of these, like I said, 2016 is really good. DMV and motor fuels particularly are really strong. You have you have new vehicle sales being strong, and you have these in-migration, these out-of-state people coming in. That's really pushing up DMV, and then with the consumption being how strong it is motor fuels is doing really well, and then motor carrier is doing well. Then as we get into 17 and 18, you see these things start to decline as sort of the economy starts to slow down. Once we hit 19, DMV turns negative. So this sort of the idea of this pent up demand for vehicle sales that had been in place as we had a recession, and then we had a really slow, kind of bumpy few years of recovery, that has led to what we've seen now is an expectation that people are buying vehicles that would have bought vehicles before, and now they're buying them now. So that's pushing up sales now. That's supposed to actually lead to a decline hitting in 2019. So that's what's pushing down DMV in 2019 and 20. As you can see, I was saying about the motor carrier piece, it's pretty consistent going across. And then in motor fuels, as we hit into 21, now we're seeing negative growth, this fuel efficiency effect being more strong, and it's leading to negative growth in motor fuels for the first time. So that's going to, overall, what it's doing to our revenues is that it's causing them to basically be flat. So this chart kind of gives you the history. You can see in 2004, these are fiscal years, you know, 2005, you can see this OTIA 3, which is that transportation package that was made for the bridges, where it hit motor carrier and DMV, that increase. And then in sort of 10, 11, 12, you see this phased approach from our Jobs and Transportation Act, the JTA, which hit DMV first and then motor carrier, then motor fuel. So you kind of see this ramp up in revenue from there. And then lately, we see this strong growth in revenue from the economic expansion. But once that sort of smooths out, we see in about 2018 it peaking, and then beyond, the revenues are flat. So that's not good for us in real dollars. This is our in current dollars, because in real dollars, once you put inflation into it, we're going to be seeing negative growth in our revenues overall.
Two things on this chart that just for you to pontificate on as the political analyst here. Oh, economist, I forgot. If you look at, and I know the reason here, but you have 2008, 2009, we see a significant downturn. I know you economists are always positive and we're always, you know, growing. But in your mind, if and when we hit a downturn, even though your model is flat, someplace in there, we're going to experience a downward trend of some proportion, and then an upward trend, of course, based on the size of the crash.
Right, Chair Haas, Senator Bohus, that's true. We don't forecast recessions, but what we're looking at is sort of a long run average. So what in reality is going to be, there'll be a down at some point, and then there'll be an up, and we're shooting towards the middle of that.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bohus.
The second point you raised was inflation, and for the benefit, I guess, of the two revenue or transport trucking guys here, right, that have been plagued to two committees. Inflation over the bit for roughly the last, since the last JTA, right, which is roughly 8 years, inflation's averaged, 2%, 2 point something, which is around 16%. And then we're hearing in our transportation hearings, chip seal costs have gone up anywhere from 2 to 300%. Any speculation other than the feds are sandbagging on inflation? That, why are we hearing from cities, counties, and even your agency that the cost of chip seal maintenance is, which is the majority of what we're really doing, is so expensive compared to the inflation rate? Is there individual factors inside the economy that are driving those costs up?
Chair Senator Bohus, it depends on what you're doing. It depends on the sort of the inflation. So if it's tied to more of an oil price, like say asphalt or something like that, that's going to kind of track closely with more of an oil price piece then. But if it's got a labor component in it, that's got wages and sort of benefits tied to it, that's going to where you're seeing probably the growth coming from more than anything
else.
2%. Not so much the actual commodity itself. Mm-hmm. So the commodities have generally been low.
Right, because I'm just observing from not only your agency, but all of the other people involved in transportation that, $1 million doesn't go $1 million anymore.
Right.
It's, upwards of a third to two-thirds less, even though standard inflation at the same period is supposedly only around 20%. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So that's what I have for you today. So if you have any additional questions, I'd be more than happy to take them.
Thank you. Any additional questions from Mr. Porter? Anything on chip seal? Anybody want to get off their chest?
Well, Mr. Chair,
it'll be paving on yours here shortly.
Well, chip seal, there are things that you don't do much, and sometimes those get more expensive because you don't do them much. Although one category might be very high, another category is actually all low. So
right.
They should, they kind of counter themselves. And just to answer the question on the Senator Bohus was asking earlier, in Article 9 in the Constitution, there are two things that are important. One is the Highway Fund dedication of revenues, and then the other one is the balance between the heavy vehicles and the light vehicles. That's part of the constitutional requirements. Usually the definition of it is 65-35. That's the rule of thumb, 65 by light, 35 by heavy, plus or minus 1 or 2%, depending on how much we find each highway cost allocation study. And so if things change in one direction, the legislature is required to move by the constitutional requirement to balance accordingly. And I think your question is under Measure 97, they would be increase in collections from fuels and so on, which might be both for heavy and light, because you will be collecting on gasoline as well as on diesel, which we don't tax today. And then we would have to make that adjustment in probably 2017 or so.
The point being, we don't know.
We're furiously looking into it.
Curiously looking.
All right. Always an interesting forecast. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Paul, who who's administering the farm worker housing tax credit, or are we on our own here? Oh, okay. We're going to take a look at this issue. Did you have an overview summary that you wanted to deal with on these proposals, or?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're running a little bit ahead of schedule. There was supposed to be some proponents here, and I was just going to kind of set the stage and briefly describe the tax credit in the group, so I can go ahead and get started on that.
Let's go ahead and get started.
Okay. So in an attempt to avoid confusion, there currently is an agricultural housing construction tax credit, and that's really kind of a capital investment tax credit. It is for the construction, rehabilitation, or acquisition of agriculture workforce housing in Oregon. It's a 50%. The credit is 50% of eligible housing costs, and it's taken evenly over 5 years. And it is certified by the Housing and Community Service Department, and there is a program cap of $3.6 million every year. This tax credit right now we're thinking is going to be part of the upcoming tax credit report. It is scheduled to sunset on January 1st, 2020, so this is one of the two housing ones that we would be, that the legislature would be reviewing early, but that's in line with the lead time necessary for these investment-type projects. So that's current law.
What's the biennial cost?
It's only about $2 to $3 million a biennium. So that's current law. Now there is a work group proposing and crafting a policy that would be focusing on a tax credit for the operating costs. So it would, the idea is that it would be a complement. It's still dealing with issues around the supply and maintenance of agricultural housing. And there is a work group trying to piece together all of that language. We do have some draft language. The group met again on Monday, and the language was modified again, and Ledge Council is actively working on that. So right now we don't have draft language. I didn't want to share an old version.
Sure.
Basically, the credit would be a percentage of the operating costs for the agricultural housing. And the focus, the group started off with trying to focus on the policy purpose for the credit, and it would mainly be to continue affordability and to increase accountability of health and safety standards and to increase available occupancy. And it would be related to, the credit would be for farm employment-related housing. So I think you're going to hear some discussion from advocates about the nuances of that. And right now the thinking is that it would be certified by housing again, and that there would be some kind of cap, an annual cap or a taxpayer cap, and the group is still working on the details of that. And then another aspect that's being considered is whether or not the credit would be transferable or refundable. A number of the potential entities would be taxable entities, so that the credit could be refundable for them, but a number of the potential claimants would be non-taxable entities, nonprofits. And so in that case, I think you're going to hear more detail from the advocates. I think you have housing authorities, maybe.
Okay.
So you have this group of entities that will earn the tax credit. Some of them are taxable and some of them are non-taxable. And being aware of the issues related to tax credits in general, for taxable entities, it could be a refundable credit. And then for non-taxable entities, it could be a transferable tax credit. The group is trying to working through which way would be the best way to move forward.
Okay. Is that why you're here, Senator? Is that your, this is your bill, the proposal? You want to come forward? Let's bring everybody up, I guess. And
perfect. Good.
Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Hass and committee. My name is Chuck Thompson, State Senator, District 26. just to give you a little history on this, I was in Senator Courtney's office last year whining about the added cost to the farming communities and others about raising paid sick leave and the minimum wage thing. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, Senator Courtney called me into his office and came up with this idea. So I want it on the record. This was not my idea. It just came out of whining. Senator Courtney listened, and we formed this group this summer. These gentlemen here were on the work group. And I'm 3 or 4 or 5 times. Probably met Farm Bureau. We had it all on this committee, and I think they've done a pretty good job of kind of ironing this thing out. Just for history of what happens, let's say on my farm, as far as housing goes, the supplying housing in the Hood River Valley, other parts of the state, has gone on for generations. I live in my grandfather's house. The basement of the house has a pool table and a working shower room, wash house. So we still have the bunk. We call it a bunkhouse where we used to house like eight people. There's 2 families in it now, but those 8 people, when they used to come up from California and stay in our bunkhouse, they would shower and do their laundry and play pool in my grandparents' basement. And that's just, it's evolved since then. The farming construction tax credit and the housing tax credit helps us to build and improve some of those new housing facilities that we've had. We've redone several. I've had one of those in the past where we built a triplex. So we were able to put 3 families in there, upgrade them from a 12-by-12 cabin unit into a 2-bedroom triplex unit. So these are really nice housings. But the thing is, after talking to Senator Courtney and talking to him about the increase in minimum wage, paid sick leave, those kind of things that we have to face now, it's really tough for us to provide, because we don't charge rent, we don't charge electricity, we don't charge water, we don't charge garbage, nothing. We have like 20 to 25 families that live in our place all year round. And then when they're not working, like in our areas, they go help other people or find employees. And they work like all year round, but most of it's seasonal. So, like, just for example, this year we had a 70% of a pear crop. And that's common in farming. It's not just pears and apples. It's wheat. It's whatever. It's forestry. It's all those natural resource things where you – sometimes your business depends on what the weather is going to do, and that's what happened to us this year. The pollen, it was so hot during bloom time, the pollen didn't ripen. It stayed viable like 4 days instead of 2 weeks, so we just set less pears. So that wasn't our fault, but now we've got 30% less income to pay for those expenses, and we pay all the electricity, water, and all that in here in the unit. So what my thing to Senator Courtney was, there's a couple points. We don't want to charge rent because we don't want to get in the rental business, but we can charge for electricity and we can charge for water. So that's where Senator Courtney came up with this idea that we should be able to recoup some of those costs so we don't go to our employees and charge them for those costs. The other thing I think this bill does that is important is what other industries in the country or the state or whatever build housing, supply housing for their workers? I don't know very many that do. So if, like in Hood River, if we didn't supply housing for our 25 families, what would the housing situation look like just in the Hood River Valley? I know that happens all over the state too. So maybe if we do a couple of these things, maybe it would entice some other industries and other businesses to get into the housing business, because if you own the land, you can go to the planning department, and like in farming, they can't stop you. You can build anywhere on your property you want, as long as it's farm labor housing. You're not going to rent it out. So it's very easy to go in and do this, and I think it could add to our lessening the stress on affordable housing, too. So those are just a couple of ideas. I've talked enough, and I'll let these gentlemen speak.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Haas and members of the committee, my name is Ramon Ramirez. I'm president of the Farmworker Union, Oregon's Farmworker Union, PECUN. And so I was probably one of the first ones to get a call from Senator Courtney around this idea. And I told him that we needed to vet this with the housing facilitation group that's been in existence in some form or another for the last 25 years to address the issue of farmworker housing. Farmworker housing is critical in making Oregon agricultural work. So the group has been around for 25 years, and this year Senator Courtney went to the housing committee, went to the facilitation farmworker housing group with this proposal and asked for the formation of a work group so that we could start working on this policy on allowing, just like what Senator Thompson said, developing a tax credit that would help the farmers and growers so that they could not charge rent to the farm workers that they have currently working in and future flow. So we started toying around with the idea. So as the bill is written currently, PECUN stands in support. Our union is in support of this proposal because it does several things. One thing that it does is that, first and foremost, from our perspective, it helps farm workers. It helps farm workers because farm workers do not have to pay the extra costs of electricity and garbage and water and sewage, which is a tremendous savings for them. Farms that are doing the right thing for farm workers, we believe, should be helped, and we believe this is something that will help the growers. The other thing that it does is that in the way the bill is written, and Peter can speak to this, Peter Henley from CASA, who's a developer and that does a lot of farm worker housing. This also allows some of the CDCs that currently exist that provide farm worker housing the ability to tap in to those tax credits so that we can leverage other funds from the feds so that we could build more housing. So that's one of the objectives that we want to be able to do this do with this housing credit. That's why we're in support of it. But I think that the other thing that we're doing is we're sending a strong message to those growers who, for example, operate labor camps that are not registered or labor contractors who are not registering their housing, whether it's a house or an apartment or a barn or a labor camp, right, that are off the radar, they're not registered with the state of Oregon, with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. This sends a strong message as an incentive to come into the system, right? Because there's an incentive here, right? And I know that there'll be a cap on this, right? So we believe that that the small investment that will be made by the state to assist growers in the long run sends a strong message to the agricultural community that those outside the system have an opportunity to come in. And I think for those reasons, that's why normally we wouldn't be supporting these types of tax credits. But we think this one is a win-win situation for both Oregon farmers, for the farm workers, and for our agricultural economy in the state. So that's why we're in support of the bill as currently written. And like I said, we've been working on this for all summer. Actually, we've been working on it before the summer because we needed to shape and set parameters here. And a group of us came and met with the senator, with Senator Courtney, and we told him what we felt would be the best scenario for developing a public policy piece that will address this issue. And so we've been working on this for almost probably about a year. So having said that, I want to introduce my colleague over here, Peter Hanley.
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Peter Hanley, Executive Director of Community and Shelter Assistance Corporation in Sherwood, Oregon, also known as CASA of Oregon, not to be confused with the other CASA. So CASA for about the last 30 years has been working to serve rural residents, primarily farm workers. We work in unison with community development corporations, CDCs, and public housing authorities to develop housing for agricultural workers and other low-income folks. So we have used the existing construction farm worker tax credit for a number of years, and primarily we use that to leverage USDA rural development federal funds to build the housing that we're building for farm workers. There are state funding sources that, because of the low wages of the farm workers, you got to have really deep subsidies in these projects. We're talking typically people that are below 30% of median income. And so what that requires is that there be sufficient subsidy so that their rent payments are not eating into their other types of things like medicine and food. And so over the last 25 years, we've created about 1,400 units spread out through 25 communities in the state of Oregon. We've also worked in Hood River and the Dalles and Wasco County to renovate a number of labor camps. And I think when you look at parts of the state where you have really well-developed, well-run labor camps, you see really successful production of agriculture. You see secure housing for these folks really means that there's better supply of labor for the farmers and better conditions for the farm workers. There's parts of the state where I don't think that's as true. I think there's, like Ramon was saying, there's a number of labor camps. There's a number of housing units out there that are employer-related types of housing where there's an opportunity to bring them into the system. Because right now, OSHA only inspects those where there's five or more units. And so there's a lot of on-farm units that are not currently under the OSHA inspection. And we're not asking to bring those in. We're basically saying, if you're willing to avail yourself of this tax credit, you will subject yourself to OSHA guidelines. And I think that could really open up some opportunities to improve some of the housing, which, you know, I personally have seen out there is in really bad shape. And so I think this tax credit provides some opportunities to do some different funding. There's currently some state funding. In fact, the legislature passed some LIFT bonds, not last session, but the session before, that could really provide some good subsidy, but it's not going to be deep enough because it's only $38,000 per unit. And when you're talking units at the minimum, let's say we're going to use a manufactured housing unit to buy and place that unit, it's still going to cost about $110,000. So if you were placing a unit that can, you know, serve, you know, a family or, you know, five unrelated individuals or so, you're still going to need to have some additional subsidy to cover the operations on that, whether that is a community-based unit run by a nonprofit or housing authority or an on-farm unit. And so I'm here to support this. I'm here. We're still working through the details. We've got the Columbia Gorge fruit growers are represented. The Farm Bureau is represented. OSHA and housing are sitting down as we're hammering this thing out. And I think we're pretty close to getting to agreement on what needs to be in there. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. One sort of devil's advocate question, I suppose, is would the sideboards be in place, or have you thought about how do I know that, for example, Senator Thompson, how do we know if we do this tax credit that you as a grower would receive that you then still won't charge for electricity and other things?
I think that's a good thing that needs to be in there somehow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, Senator Haas, members of the committee, the work group has talked about that. It's come been a recurrent theme, and I think all of us are concerned that these state resources are protected. You know, the question is, at what cost? And, you know, is self-certification going to be enough? We currently use self-certification along with some OSHA inspections for when we use the current construction credit. And I think if you were to do a tour up through Hood River County and talk to some of the residents of those camps, you would find out that, you know, they aren't charging rent. Now, but that's certainly something that we're going to need to make sure gets in there, either through statute or through regulation.
Mm-hmm. Senator Bokwist?
Oh, no, I was just thinking the lawyers from the Grand Bargain ought to be able to hop out here.
Questions? Well, thank you. Thank you, Senator. Both of these concepts will be reviewed in 2017, whether to re-up on the one and or whether to add or combine. So, thanks. Good luck in your continuing fine-tuning. Thanks for your help.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I think we've reached the end here, Paul. Is there any announcements?
Mr. Chair, I just want to remind the committee your next meeting is November 16th, which will be a revenue forecast meeting that we called our bonus meetings. So that'll be before the legislative days in December. And, of course, it'll be after the election, so you'll have a better idea of kind of what the revenue picture looks like post-election. So that'll be a updated forecast. And that, of course, will also be the forecast in which the governor's budget will be based on.
Oh, yeah.
November 16th.
Senator Bokwist.
At some future point, probably not November, but I'd be curious for the staff to pontificate on something that I have just observed today compared to the revenue forecast that I missed. And today we heard from the DMV of driver's licenses around 100,000 a year from DMV. And he did mention 2 to 3% job growth, but then I went back to the forecast you guys just have. I mean, the differential between 100,000 new driver's license from out-of-state people and the creation of 36,000 jobs is really big. And the economic impacts from an economist of that and the revenue impacts of, okay, 64,000 people got to live somehow.
Mm-hmm. Senator, that's right. I mean, that is a large in-migration. But remember that those licenses surrendered are only one half the equation. The other half is the licenses surrendered by Oregonians moving to Washington or Idaho or California. So that there's a netting effect that happens there in terms of the net in-migration.
That's what I'd like you to pontificate in the future.
But the net in-migration has been very strong. I mean, we had a period of relatively slow net in-migration because there was very limited mobility in the economy overall. And now we've really seen that pick up, and it's been a big factor in the numbers here the last couple of years.
Mike, I could easily see that we have a lot of people moving here without jobs, which means the revenuers in joint ways and means are going to come looking for us to raise more revenue to help those people. My question is, how big is the lift?
Mm-hmm. Or to get those folks money if they're coming here with a lot of money and retiring.
I'm with that. I'm with you on that one, too. Especially those rich retired lawyers.
Portlandia, where young people can go to retire.
Sounds like
okay, well, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
With that, we will adjourn.